Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Growth Matters Radio.
Well, good morning. Here we are on another Friday for our Growth Matters show. And today we have two guests who are going to do what I sort of call as a crowdfunding 101. So, you know, that's a topic that's getting a lot more press and a lot more people thinking about it. And a lot of people ask sort of what is that and what are the mechanics? And so we have two people today that are going to help us understand a little bit more about it. One of our guests is David Lellenfeld, and he is the CEO and co-founder of Sterling Funder. And Sterling Funder is Atlanta-based, and it's an equity and debt crowdfunding portal, which provides an innovative approach to connecting startup companies seeking capital but with qualified investors. So he can give us that perspective from someone who is talking to a number of companies and people that are willing to help get in this. And so, David, thanks so much for being here this morning.
All right, Michelle. Thank you for having us.
And then we have Mark Shakiro.
Shakiro.
Almost.
Close.
Mark Shakiro, CEO of Caregiver Communications. And Caregiver Communications provides information that helps improve the lives of caregivers and those they care for, which I know for a lot of our listening audience, many people are in that stage where that's something that you're having to think about. And so Mark, as he shares some of his experiences, he can give us some perspective on how to help us deal with that issue. So welcome, Mark.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. So before we get started really diving into the idea of crowdfunding, why don't each of you share what I call the sort of the nickel tour of your background, of how you got to sort of doing the things that you're doing today. And so I'll just start with you, David. Tell us a little bit about your professional background.
Sure. I'm a native of New York City, so I spent my first 23 years in New York City and really enjoyed it, and went from New York to law school at Ohio State. So I was in Columbus, Ohio, and finished law school there. Spent a year in Boston, which was a lot of fun, working on a family business. And then after that kind of wrapped up, I moved from Boston to Atlanta moved for 3 months. And that was, 20 years ago almost. So I moved to Atlanta and started practicing law, and I still have always had businesses that I've been involved with, either as a founder or sort of as a minor investor. So I've been stayed involved with the entrepreneurial community, and I've also practiced law. My specialty is intellectual property law, so I do that. And then my most recent kind of entrepreneurial endeavor has been Sterling Funder and getting involved with the equity crowdfunding industry. And we started that about a year ago, and it's going great. There's a ton of interest in crowdfunding. I think people recognize that it's sort of a game changer for the capital finance industry. And so we're real excited. We were early stages of the industry, early stages of the company, but everything's looking good and trending up, and we're getting excited about it. So I spend a ton of time both practicing law and getting Sterling Funder going.
Yeah, I was doing a little bit of background reading, and I love one of the things that you say in your mission: we provide the platform, education, and tools to shift the power from Wall Street to Main Street, given all that we've seen in the last couple years. That just really resonates. Also, when I was listening to you, of all the places that you've been, all I could think of was the snow they've been getting this year, given the challenges that Atlanta has had in the last couple of weeks. So, Mark, tell us a little bit about you and your background.
I'm from Rhode Island originally, and I've been in printing and publishing most of my life. I began printing back in 1971, working in a press room, sweeping floors and such. Then I worked for a small commercial printer in Rhode Island and moved on to a Fortune 500 printer. And that's how I got to Atlanta. They moved me around from Washington to Orlando to Atlanta, where I was promoted to the youngest sales manager within the corporation. And then I went on my own in 93. And my first company was a print brokering company, and I ran that for 18 years. And during that time, one of my old customers became a partner of mine, and we started a publishing company here in Atlanta called Vinings Publishing, which publishes children's travel journals. And then a few years ago, after a family incident where my sister passed away unexpectedly when we were dealt with caregiving situations, we went out looking for different types of information for caregiving, and it struck home that there was a need for the information and how to find out what the resources were and so on, so we formed Caregiver Communications. And we've been working on this for a number of years, and now we're to a point where we need additional funding to grow, and that's why we're here with crowdfunding.
Yeah, I'm struck by a couple things I want to maybe probe a little bit more, Mark. How is it different, or is it, being an entrepreneur in a business that you have, you know, some professional background in, and one that is sort of connected to something that's very personal and is an outgrowth of something that, as I said, is very personal for you?
It started out basically combining up my publishing background with this passion or personal need. And we started out with magazines, providing information for caregivers in three cities, Orlando, Atlanta, and Charlotte. And we found that the magazines were very well received by our audience, the unpaid caregivers. We also found that the companies that provide goods and services to this community needed a way to get in front of them. However, the magazine ads were at a price point that was too high for the local advertisers. So doing more research, we realized a way to go internet, to put up a website that is right now very fragmented and underserved, that we had an opportunity to come in to provide information to more caregivers across the country and provide a low-cost and effective way for all the companies that provide products and services, a way to get in front of this audience.
Yeah, I love how sometimes our guests have that evolution where a number of different things that are important to you kind of come together to...
Being an entrepreneur, one of the things that you learn to do is to pivot quickly.
Ah.
And when one thing, you see an opportunity, one door closes, as they say, you say, here's an opportunity here. We had our magazines up on the internet, and they were nice. You could go read them, but if you had a magazine, you did not need to go to the website. But we learned more in doing research and so on, learned how to make it, how to generate revenue on the internet, and how to change. So we shut down the magazine and focused entirely on the internet.
Yeah. So, David, how did you know that you could be an entrepreneur? What was it that let you know, yep, I can strike out here and create something new in the marketplace?
I don't function well in big organizations. I've learned that. So, no, I mean, basically, it just, I guess it's the way some folks are born, willing to take risks and realizing that... making the rules is probably better for them than following the rules. So I think things like that, and then, you know, particularly with crowdfunding, it's the opportunity to have an impact here in Atlanta has been really exciting as well. So, I mean, you've got to be willing to take a risk. So if you're too risk-averse, it's probably not the right move for you. So I think risk tolerance has a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
I have to agree with that. The other thing that I noticed when I was selling printing, there was one salesman on the West Coast, and he always found these great leads. And I was, how did you find these? He said, well, I just read the newspapers, magazines. And that's where I realized I started to think more like an entrepreneur, and that is you see opportunities where others just see something going on. It's almost the Sherlock Holmes approach. Everybody sees the same thing, but not everybody observes the same thing. So when you read or see something and you say, there's an opportunity there, that to me is the entrepreneurial thinking that's saying, I can make a business out of that. Yes, there's risk associated with that. You need to have thick skin. You need to be persistent. You need to be passionate. You need to be patient. But when you see these opportunities, you have a different mindset and a different way of thinking. And that to me is when you know that you're an entrepreneur.
Yeah, so I want to shift a little bit, beginning to talk about this whole concept. I've sort of previewed that we're going to do kind of crowdfunding 101. But before we even, first, why don't we just define what is that for a listener that maybe has heard the term but really doesn't understand, what is crowdfunding?
Crowdfunding is basically sourcing money from the public for a cause or a company. So equity crowdfunding, which is really what is taking place or coming of age now, is collecting money from the crowd and the company giving equity in their business. So the folks that are giving the money are getting ownership in the company they're giving it to. So that would be equity crowdfunding. But, you know, what's been around for a few years in this country is something called reward crowdfunding. People may be familiar with Kickstarter. So, and that is folks who give money get some type of, swag or reward for giving the money to the company, but they don't get equity in the company. Mm. So things are evolving, and security laws in the country are, we've been relying up until really last year, we've been relying on security laws that were written in the 1930s and obviously did not have any sort of recognition of the internet or ability to adapt to the internet. So it took a change in security law nationally for equity crowdfunding to become possible. And that's really what's allowed equity crowdfunding to become start to emerge now.
Yeah, so let's just also, that is a great sort of definition to understand what we're talking about. Let's also step back a little bit. And for a startup, for an entrepreneur, what are some of the ways in which you can get funding so that we can kind of see where does this fit? So, Mark, just from talking with you, you've done a number of different funding.
Right. My first company, I bootstrapped and funded myself through my savings and investments and so on. So that's the first thing you do is you bootstrap, you use your own money. After you go through that, you go to your friends and family, and you ask them, usually it's, you say a loan or whatever, or investing in the company, usually it's a gift. And they think that you've got a good idea, they like you, you've been a good kid, or here's some money, good luck to you, and away you go. That's fine. And if you can have enough money out of those two things and you take off, that's good. But a lot of times now you need more money or you don't have any savings, especially young people today using a Kickstarter. So they go to the crowdfunding or whatever, and they use something like a Kickfunder. And it's interesting, the reward-based, to me, is more of a gift. You give some money to them because when we get into the equity base, that to me is more of a reward than just getting a mug or a T-shirt or a hat that says, hey, or you get a cookie named after you or something like that. You like the idea, and here's the money. Equity-based crowdfunding, though, to me is a step between your friends and family and the angel investor stage. And the angel investors are what we call accredited individuals. They have a certain net worth. They have a certain yearly income. And they're supposedly more knowledgeable investors. And they will come in and listen to you, and they give you money or they invest in your company for a piece of it. They don't necessarily want to get involved in the day-to-day operations. They want to give you some money, and they expect a certain return. Now, it's a high-risk investment on their part, and they expect in 3 to 5 years a 5 to 10 times return, not 12%, not 10%. We're talking about 500%, 300 to 500%. Now, and in an angel portfolio, when you look at them, how they invest and what their mindset is, out of 10 possible investments, they know that 3 or 4 or 5 are going to go belly up. And they know that. They also know that maybe 3 or 4 or 2 or 3 are going to break even. But those 2, 3, or 4 at the top, they're going to be home runs. Those are the ones going to finance the risk. So they're high-risk investors, and they understand the risk involved. In crowdfunding, the people that go in for the equity don't necessarily understand the risk involved. If they're accredited investors, yes, they do. But we'll talk about what Georgia is doing in a little while. And then after that, if you get the money from the angel investor, you're doing well, but now you need, instead of $500,000 or $1 million, you need $5 million, $7 million. There the venture capitalists come in, and they put in the big stake, but they also get very involved in the running of your company, and they want to take it to an IPO or an exit event of some sort in a short period of time. So you start out by yourself, then you go to your family and friends, and then you used to go to angel investors after you grew to a certain point, but now there's a spacer in there. There's another step, which is crowdfunding.
Yeah, so thank you for that. That was a real good explanation of sort of the continuum of right. ways to fund a startup. So, David, in this idea of Sterling Funder, what is it that you provide to help businesses in this crowdfunding space?
Well, we're creating a marketplace. So, I mean, you need in crowdfunding, you need a lot of opportunities, and then you need a lot of investors. So, Sterling Funder, really, you can think about think of us as the marketplace. It's a place where investors meet entrepreneurs and dialogue with each other and determine whether these are good investments for the individual investor. It's also a place for investors to talk to each other. So part of crowdfunding, really, the principle of it, one of the big principles is it's the collective intelligence of the crowd that will decide what the right investments are. To accomplish that, we give the investors an ability to communicate with each other during the due diligence process. So it's a group of investors that don't know each other necessarily, but they've got expertise, they've got interest in a company, and they vet the company together. Hmm. So that's a big part of it, and that's really so. Sterling Fund is the marketplace, but let me make I think the important point too is this is an emerging industry, and part of why I think it's great that you're helping to spread the word and Mark's here talking about his great company is to educate Georgians, educate really the country on what crowdfunding is. So you have to understand that we're early, the industry is very early. Georgia's special has done some things specially that allowed us to crowdfund way before any other state. So it's really hard to, we're not in the position of really articulating exactly how the industry is, except I'm here as an advocate for crowdfunding to help spread the word and get the crowdfunding industry moving.
And so both of you sort of alluded to some things that are happening in Georgia from a legislation standpoint, if I understand it. And so what...
David can address that.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, so Georgia and Kansas is really the first state to allow equity crowdfunding. And then Georgia was the second state. So, and a few states have come along, but there's something called intrastate crowdfunding. And so what that means is in Georgia, if the company is Georgia-based, like Mark's, like Caregiver is, it can raise money from Georgia residents on a Georgia portal. Mm-hmm. So and that makes it an intrastate transaction. And if it's an intrastate transaction, it's exempt from the majority of the federal security law, and the states really have the right to then govern how that occurs. And so what Secretary Kemp, Georgia Secretary of State Kemp has done, and people in his office, has been outstanding and has really put Georgia on the map in terms of what crowdfunding is and allowing it to start to mature in Georgia. And really the nationwide, people in the industry, regulators in other countries and other states, finance folks, everybody's watching Georgia to see how equity crowdfunding evolves. And Georgia's really, I call it the equity crowdfunding capital of the country, and we're really starting to get there.
There is the Invest Georgia exemption right now. We talked about accredited investors having a certain net worth and such. Well, what Georgia has said is if you're a Georgia corporation and you're applying for crowdfunding, then a Georgia resident can invest up to $10,000 if they're a non-accredited investor. So that opens the door up to any Georgian that wanted to invest in the country. So what they're hoping is you're giving them a chance to get in on the next Facebook, the next Google at a entry-level position, and you hope that it's going to take off for them. Otherwise, you have to be an accredited investor to purchase on the equity versus a crowdfunder, which is handing off $25, $100 on equity based. For instance, on my launch, we're looking at a minimum investment of $5,000 for a non-accredited investor and a maximum of $10,000. Different type of person, different expectations, different investors, and so on.
Yeah, so maybe what would be helpful is to kind of walk our audience through kind of the process. So I hear this today, and now I'm like, this makes sense for me either as an investor or as a company. So Mark, when you decided this was something that you wanted to look at, one, what was sort of impetus that said, now this is time to think about using this particular vehicle for your company?
For the amount of money that we're looking to raise, the Kickstarter model was not realistic for us. However, the equity-based model, where you could have a higher investment per person, was much more attractive to us. So I went to Sterling Funder, which was the first in Georgia to platform to offer this, and went through their approval process, which is very detailed as far as forms to fill out. They have to do background checks on you. They go through and they vet you to make sure that you are who you say you are. You're not trying to scam the investor, the public out there. And they take a look at your model. One of the problems with some of the other fundraising things, for instance, I did a pay-to-pitch years ago.
What is that for our listeners that maybe aren't aware?
That was an opportunity to pitch my company in front of a group of angel investors. However, it came with a price tag. And I went up and I pitched. I had my 20 minutes, and it cost me about $3,000. People thanked me, and the only person that made money in the room that night was the person who was running the show. Mm-hmm. And there were people up there that shouldn't have been up there. I felt that they were not qualified. They weren't at a position to be there. It was a waste of their time and their money, as well as the audience. What Sterling does is they take a look at the applications, and they don't accept everybody. You have to go through the process, and they do vet so that their reputation is on the line as well, because when you go to their website, if you see some of these, you know, A, B, and C companies that, gosh, oh, yeah, they're going to raise, you know, X number of dollars, but their projections are for half that in 5 years, it's not a good investment. Mm-hmm. So, David, you probably can talk more about that, but that's something that Sterling offers to the investors.
So let's pause there. So you heard about Sterling Funder. You knew this was something that you wanted to do, and you submitted an application. So from your perspective, David, you know, without going through all the mechanics, sort of what are some key things that you're looking at to say this is a viable organization that can be a part of this process?
Well, I mean, a big part of it is who's in charge. So you've got to get that's a big indicator for us. So with Mark's company, we were really comfortable with Mark, with his experience, with his ability to lead, with his integrity. So that's kind of the first thing you look at. And then after that, there's a lot of fact-checking that goes on. So like Mark mentioned, if we'll verify the information on the application is correct, we'll take kind of a common-sense approach to look at the business. Is this a viable business? Is this something that makes sense? And really, at the folks who co-founded Sterling Funder with me are investors themselves. They've been involved with private equity deals for many, many years and serve as angel investors. So they kind of know what to look for as well with their experience. But ultimately, the nice thing about crowdfunding is ultimately really the crowd, again, it's the crowd that's really the decision maker on the investment. So it's not, we don't see our role as to say, here's a great company, everyone need to invest in it. That's really not our role. We try to just say, here's a good opportunity, and let the crowd figure out what's the right investment for them.
Yeah, and typically, how long does it take from when the time that someone might contact you to then kind of go through that process?
You put a term limit. You can put a term limit on that. If you don't hit your number, in a certain amount of time, then whatever money you collected goes back to the investors. Mm-hmm. And that's up to you as far as how much.
The application process was, I mean, it could be as short as 30 days. And sometimes it takes longer. I mean, we don't put companies up until their application's complete. And sometimes it could take a little bit longer to do some of the more complicated aspects of the application, like financial projections. So we've had folks that we've worked with for 90 days, but I would say typically 30 to 40 days is probably the average.
Right, Sterling, they have a great team, and they're great to work with. I've learned a lot from them. They're nice people, good people. But they go through your business plan, they go through your projections and so on, and they take a look at the business to make sure, as David said, it is viable. It looks like there is a chance, good chance of success there because, as we said, people come in and they go, oh, we invested in a Sterling Funder company and it went belly up in 2 weeks or whatever. That's not going to help them out either.
Yeah. So I'm interested, Mark, since you have had a number of different sort of financing experiences with your different businesses, what's something you've learned from just the process from where you are now working with Sterling?
One of the things about crowdfunding for this is that you don't just put your company, your proposal up on Sterling and walk away from it and expect people to come and start writing your checks. You have to work your network, and you have to be very diligent and talk to people, get out there, network, go to different functions and so on. One of the things I have found is that when you tell people, yes, I'm doing equity crowdfunding on Sterling Funder, it gives you more credibility. Mm. It gives you a little panache. People say, oh, really? Because they know you had to go through a process to get there and that you wouldn't be up there if you weren't a good, viable, potential company. So that gives you a little more cred when you're out there talking to angel investors and so on.
So talk a little bit about sort of working that network and kind of what it takes. Like you said, it's not just, although it's not the same analogy, mm-hmm. it made me think of, we've used Craigslist to put stuff out there. You know, your thing goes to the bottom. If you don't work it, you a lot of times don't get a bite. So what are you doing and kind of how's this process working for you?
It's been a real education. As you go out and you start talking to people, especially in the beginning, you're desperate for money. You're hungry. You want to talk to anybody. And there are people out there that prey on you. Mm. And there are also those out there that misrepresent themselves. And one of the things, one example that I had was someone came up to me and said, oh, what are you doing? Love your idea. Do you have a term sheet? I said, yes. Send it to me. So we sent him the term sheet, and we asked him, are you an investor? Yes, I am. I'm interested. Well, he came back 2 days later and said, this is a terrible term sheet. This is garbage. However, for $2,500, my law firm can put together a great term sheet for you. He wasn't an investor. He was out there looking for business. So you have to be able to differentiate who's out there truly our investors. And a lot of times you get out there and you're talking to other entrepreneurs, and you don't, that's nice, but you don't want to talk to them. You want to talk to the money.
Yeah, so David, what kind of advice do you give to people that you're working with to kind of help them navigate some of the challenges, even though this is a great opportunity?
Well, Mark's right. I mean, Mark's done a great job of staying involved with the process. And it's really a combination of our network at Sterling Funder and pushing it out to the people that we have in our database in combination with, like Mark mentioned, him reaching out to the folks that are in his company's database. So you've got to combine both, and you've got to work at it. And Mark's job and our job is especially difficult now because folks don't know about crowdfunding. So we're working hard to bring awareness to it. And I mean, Mark's really stuck with the process. He's been patient. He understands the benefits of it. But it's up to everybody to keep working hard at it and getting the word out.
That's so true. And one of the things about crowdfunding, from what I've read, and how the crowd controls it, there's a certain point in your funding raise, in your campaign, that if you hit, I don't know if it's 50% or something like that, 80% of the people that, or 90% of the people that hit 50% of their raise are successful.
Hmm.
So it's kind of people are on the outside, they're watching, and they're watching the ticker go up, and they want to see who else is in there. I don't want to be the first one, and if it's getting up there, now I want to jump in. So they're watching, and they're seeing how fast is that ticker going on, and now they feel more comfortable. They say, it's got a better chance. I want a part of it as well.
Yeah, so what's the strategy or what's some tips that you might give our listening audience to how do you attract that, we got great ideas, mm-hmm. and they're out there. What is something that owners can do to attract sort of those first couple of investors? What are some strategies that they can use?
I think the best thing is to tap into their personal network. And that's really the place where you're most likely to get the most kind of intrepid investors or the people that you know, the people that trust you, people that maybe have invested with you before. So that's really the best place to look, the kind of the friends and family, and get them involved. And that's probably the best place for the first money to come from.
And psychologically, do that before you launch. Hmm. Get out there and talk to your network and get the people interested and committed and that they've pledged the money. So then when you do launch your campaign, all of a sudden you get a quick uptick. People say, oh, that's hot, and then they'll get on. So the quicker you can do that, if you do your homework ahead of time before you launch your campaign, you'll have better results.
Yeah.
So you have to be very proactive. You've got this window before you do launch, and you can control your launch date when you go live so that, boom, you get some interest.
So I'm curious, Mark, what's sort of happening in the company? You know, so we're talking about this financing. You needed it to do some kind of growth or to do some kind of investment. What's happening to the employees and others that are in the company? Is they know that this is going on, or do they even know that it's going on?
They know what's going on. They're being very patient. They understand that this is a process, that it does take time. Everyone on my team has been affected by caregiving, so they're very passionate about the cause, and they're ready to get going. But they also understand that I can't ask them to do too much until I have the funding to pay them. So it's a cart and a horse situation. We've taken the company as far as we can on the funds that we had. Now, in order to grow and expand, we need additional funding. So everyone's sitting there. I get calls on a daily basis. How are we doing? How are we doing? How much is in? When do we get started? And I wish I had a firm date for them, but at this point, I don't.
Yeah, so maybe that's also taking us back to, so we can learn a little bit more about caregiver. What is it that you're looking to grow and to do as you are successful in
this approach? Our audience are the unpaid caregivers across the country, and there are between 60 and 70 million caregivers right now, and that number is going to grow up to 85 million by 2050. So they need information, because caregiving is often event-driven. We think we're prepared. It doesn't happen. We take care of seniors, disabled veterans, children with special needs, accident victims, those with a disease. And the average caregiver spends about $5,000 a year on caregiver goods and services. So that becomes a $300 billion plus market a year. So our audience needs information, and they also need to know not only what to do, but where to go to get the resources and the help. Those people, those companies are our customers, and they advertise on us, so we bring them together. So the funding that we're raising right now will enable us to build out our demo website into an operating website where we can connect our audience with our advertisers, so we can go out and continue to create and acquire content for our website articles. We can do the marketing, digital and traditional marketing, to promote our site so people know where we are and will come to us. We also need to build a sales force to go out and sell the advertising for us and ongoing operations.
Okay.
So that's what we're doing.
David, are there particular industries or types of companies that are more attractive to this type of investing? Or is it pretty much anybody with a good idea and can meet the criteria?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly funny, we're basically what I call industry agnostic. So we don't have a particular focus in industry. But I think for crowdfunding, what I think is fascinating about it is there'll be, once we really get the industry going, there'll be investors from every walk of life, from every industry, and they'll be looking for investments in what they know and what they understand. So I think our job is to supply and have good companies up that are in every industry so there'll be more appeal to the variety of investors that are on our site. But I wanted to mention too, like, something that, you know, we're talking a lot about on the company side, which is really important, but crowdfunding really is also going to be a benefit for the investors. I mean, the unaccredited investors and even a lot of accredited investors have been left out of this process entirely, this process of investing in privately held companies and startup companies. When Twitter went public not too long ago, I was told that everybody who became a millionaire because of the IPO was already a millionaire because they had stock. But so nobody really is benefiting other than folks who are already wealthy. And, you know, if any of us, any normal American wanted to have shares of Twitter before the IPO, it was really impossible because you would have needed to put in millions and millions of dollars in investment. So folks like Mark, who are excellent entrepreneurs, outstanding companies, they're going to be a beneficiary of crowdfunding. But it's a whole new investment class for the entire country, because they're tired of getting 1.5% interest. They're tired of investing in only investing in public equities because you have no control really over the price of Coca-Cola stock. But when you get involved with crowdfunding as an investor, you have an opportunity to help the business. So you're putting money in, but you're also becoming an advocate for the business. You can become a customer of the business. You can spread the word. You can maybe advise the company. You can provide connections for the company. So there's a lot. This is a whole new opportunity, not just for entrepreneurs, but for the investors as well.
That's what made it so attractive to us, because caregiving affects so many people. We thought not only do we believe it's a good, sound investment, but it's also a way for people to support this and to get out and spread the word about it and help us be successful and also help other caregivers.
Yeah, and I appreciate you sort of helping our listening audience understand the benefit from both sides. So is there a typical profile of an investor? So now I'm sitting here listening to Growth Matters in my office, and I'm thinking, this sounds like an interesting idea. Kind of what advice do you give to the investor, and how do they play?
Well, what's great is that it's not a high-ticket item. So I would encourage investors to get involved with, like Marcus pointed out, all startups are high-risk investments, so you have to understand that going in. But I would encourage folks to start with small dollar amounts and really just slowly get involved with the process. This isn't something where you take your life savings or your retirement and put it into a startup. I mean, that's not the right idea. The right idea is to take small amounts and to read about the companies, invest in companies that you understand, that you're comfortable with, that have good management teams, and slowly get involved with the process. So that would be my primary piece of advice is you're not looking to buy a lottery ticket. You're looking to get educated and understand the companies and really, use your common sense and use your personal experience. So, for example, with Mark, I mean, I think that people would understand and if they have publishing experience, and you're an investor and you happen to have publishing experience, you're going to be attracted to Mark's company. And that's kind of one of the profiles on Sterling Funder that you're going to want to spend more time with. So find the ones that you have an understanding of. And if you're, a caregiver, you're going to be a particular interest in what Mark is doing and have a better understanding of the benefits of his work rather than somebody who hasn't been in that position.
Yeah, so it's, when you read articles and different things about investing in stock or things like that, talk about that there's a lot, if it appeals to you and if it's something that you're connected to, then, do your due diligence. Those are probably the types of things that make sense to invest in. So it's kind of the same principle.
And I see crowdfunding in the future. The people that come in and invest in a startup, whatever, and do well. They have a good return 4 or 5 times. They're going to take their money out and say, I'm going to look for another startup to invest in. I'm going to do some more crowdfunding. And that's how it's going to grow in time as it goes out. I'd also like to see the financial planners that are out there that advise you on your portfolio and such, maybe saying, okay, here's a new opportunity. And you're not going to, as David said, you're not going to take 85% of your 401k and put it into this company. But you can take a small part of it, and it's worth the risk. It looks pretty good, or why don't you find something you like, and let's try it, because it could have a big return on it. And if that happens, we'll try something again. So I think as they become more aware of that and the potential there, that we'll start seeing more action in this.
So how big is the crowd right now with Sterling Funder? Can you give our audience a sense of kind of how many are in the marketplace right now?
Yeah, I mean, there's thousands. Crowdfunding is really what we're doing is largely Georgia-based. So, I mean, there's thousands of folks have signed up as investors inside of Georgia, and I mean, several thousand from outside of Georgia that are kind of waiting for the federal law to take place. So, the key is adding to those numbers, but also the key is getting the current folks in our database active. Getting them very involved. That's kind of one of the challenges now is get them comfortable with crowdfunding, get them educated on crowdfunding, and get them involved. And we're doing a lot of things to do that. I mean, we send out content, and we have a ton of educational materials about crowdfunding on our site for entrepreneurs and for investors. So it's a matter of getting them involved and getting them educated and getting them active.
And for Georgia residents to go on the Sterling Funder site to be qualified as an investor for Georgia, they only have to get their residency verified.
Hmm. Okay.
So it doesn't cost them anything. They can just go on and they check. It's about a 24-hour, I guess, verification process where, yes, you do live in Sandy Springs or Atlanta. Then you can go in and look at the companies that have listed or on Sterling and take a look at them and see what they if they appeal to you or not. There's no risk involved at that point.
Right. So tell me a little bit about the Georgia Crowdfunding Association. One of the things both of you have said is you're wanting to sort of be the evangelists and advocates for this as a process. So that sounds to me like an organization that can help get the word out. Tell us a little more about it.
Yeah, Georgia Crowdfunding Association is a Georgia nonprofit with the primary purpose of educating the public about equity crowdfunding. And one of the things we'll be doing also, I'm one of the co-founding board members of that association. And so we're getting out and educating the public, and we're also trying to set high-quality standards for everybody inside of the industry to make sure that it's done not just well, but do it really, you know, top-notch and be the best. Like I said, the state's being watched nationally. So we kind of feel like we've got a great opportunity to make a name for Georgian crowdfunding, but also we have a responsibility to make sure it's done right so that other states can get confident and allow crowdfunding in their places.
Yeah, as I've been listening to you, when you said that you are one of the founders of the association and you're a co-founder of Sterling Funder and you are an attorney that does intellectual property. So what that says to me is you do a lot of different things. And Mark and I were talking before that, you know, being an entrepreneur, there's just a number of things that you get involved in. I always like to find out for our listening audience, tell us a little bit about how you balance that, how you prioritize sort of running these companies and making sure that they're successful so that you're focused on the right thing. So, Mark, if you know, I was going to ask you, a lot of my clients, they laugh because I'm always saying, what are the two or three things? So if you were going to tell a entrepreneur that has a good business idea, is needing more funding, and is grappling with this whole issue, how do you stay focused? How do you make sure that you can kind of get all these things done?
If you have a good idea, that's great. But you have to have some business behind it. So first thing is to put together a good, solid business plan so that you know what you're going to do, step one, step two, and step three, and to do the financials that go along with it. Years ago, I didn't know what a business plan was, and someone said, do it for your sales territory. So I did all my projections. And the person looked at it, my boss said, that's nice, but how are you going to get those numbers? How are you going to generate that revenue? Where is it going to be spent? So that's the business side, the plan of it. So young entrepreneurs, do your business plan, get organized and understand what you have to do and put together a plan for it. And second is to surround yourself with as many good people as possible. If it's a small company, it's just you and I've done that, that's great. It also depends on what you want the company to be. Is it a company that you want to work and run for the rest of your life? Is it a company that you want to build and turn over to your family? Is it something that you want to build and continue to generate revenue from it but retire? Or is it one that you want to turn over in 3 to 5 years or take it to an IPO? So when you kind of work it backwards, figure out what you want it to do, and then as you design your company, work it back to front.
Mm-hmm. So, David, what helps you prioritize and stay focused?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the key is setting priorities. You've got to figure, if you look at what you need to do, and it's a huge list, probably harder to get it done, but if you say these are the top three things I need to do, and make sure you get them done, and I mean, I'm big at, get it done. As quick as you can, as efficiently as you can, and go on to the next thing. So, and if it's, If you don't get it done, you've got to really figure out what exactly needs to be done. I think a lot of folks wind up doing things that they know they need to do it, and they for some reason don't get it done. And then the other mistake they make is they do things that don't really need to be done. So So I think that's been the key for me to be able to keep everything moving, is really having an honest, you know, self-talk. Does this need to be done? And if so, if the answer is yes, then absolutely, positively get it done as quick as you can so that you can tackle the other must-haves.
I'm very goal-oriented. So when I set up my goals, is, you know, the list to get things done, and you prioritize them. But you also have to put the time on it. They have to be realistic and so on and measurable so that you know that you are making progress.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, if I say, yes, next year I want to make $1 million, well, that's great. How are you going to do it? And what steps need to be done?
You know, I was reading an article this morning, and it was talking about failure. That, you know, those that really play it safe, the chances of you experiencing, you know, some big failure that teaches you something is probably not high. But it's also those that are successful see that failure as a stepping stone to something more. They evaluate, and then they move on. But the thing that was interesting in this particular article, it was saying that women tend to personalize the failure as sort of their own, and men sort of see it as, well, that was the circumstance that happened, and, you know, these factors were part of it, and while I had something to do with it, it, you know, it was not a personal failure.
Right.
I give you that lead-in because I think it's always helpful to our listeners who are out here, just like we all are as entrepreneurs, scrapping every day, to sometimes hear an experience from somebody else that maybe was a, maybe not a failure, but something that was a disappointment or something that didn't quite go the way you wanted it to, and it did set you up to get you to where you are today. You know, you can look back and you can say, oh, that taught me something or positioned me. I'd be interested. Yeah. Everybody's got a story. So, David, what might be something that could sort of give that principle to our listening audience from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what you said, and it's basically, it's not a failure if you learn something. So, I mean, it's a failure if you don't learn the lesson and you don't have a takeaway, then it's a failure. But, yeah, certainly with, like Mark's pointed out, that you need to have good people around you. So hiring decisions, you know, there's been some mistakes made just in the past with hiring decisions. So I think I've gotten better at that. I've tried to learn lessons from those. And certainly as a manager of people, I've made mistakes. So I learned from them, and you just try to kind of recalibrate. But some of them specifically, like not spending enough time with people as the manager, not communicating enough. Those are things that I've done in the past that I work hard and try to make sure I don't do it. I have a journal here I carry with me everywhere, and there's a whole lot of listen here about what I need to do weekly, monthly, and daily. And so I try to use that to keep me on track, because there's things we don't do intuitively that we kind of have to force ourselves to do. So I keep a book and just make sure I communicate with the team and stay involved and don't just make assumptions that they know what's going on. So communicating, those are kind of the failures that I've had that I've learned from and keep marching on.
Mark?
Well, you shouldn't be afraid of failure. I mean, it does happen. It's where are some of our experiences? That includes the failures. So as David said, there should always be a takeaway. Sometimes it's good to fail fast instead of dragging things on. If something looks like it's going down, get off the ship and let it go. Sometimes there are things that failure comes and you had nothing to do with. One example, we have my publishing company, we do children's travel journals. Our first book was my trip to Washington, D.C. Great book, good response. We did our first shipment of books in August of 2001. 9/11 hit. So it killed the tourist industry to Washington, D.C., and that was it. So we recouped from that, and we had to get a contract with a larger publishing company with a sales force, marketing, and so on. And we searched around, and we signed a contract with a larger firm located in Gretna, Louisiana. We signed that in the April before Katrina hit. We lost another 2 years on that.
Wow.
So sometimes your snake bit and you go down has nothing to do with what you did. So we learned that these things do happen. You know, buck up and go forward from there.
Keep it up. Well, it has been a great show this morning and giving this little tutorial on crowdfunding and how this is emerging. I would love for both of you perhaps to come back in the future so that we can get an update both on sort of the industry, as you said, trying to get the word out, but also, Mark, how you've been able to use this vehicle and kind of what are some of the things that have transformed in your company. So I would love to hope that you would both come back.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you.
That'd be great.
Yeah, so let's make sure that our listening audience knows how to get in touch with both of you and your organizations and also the Georgia Crowdfunding Association. So, David, give us a little bit of the contact information so people can be in touch with you.
Okay. My email is david@sterlingfunder.com. Our website is obviously sterlingfunder.com. And then the Georgia Crowdfunding, it's georgiacrowdfundingassociation.com. You can just enter that into Google, too, and it'll bring up our URL. So those are the best ways to get in touch with us.
And to get in touch with me, you can go to the Sterling Funder site and register there, and you can go in and see our offer there and read all the information. It includes the business plan, financials, and everything else.
So give us the name of your the organization again so people know.
Caregiver Communications.
Okay.
Or you can reach me at my private email, which is M. Shakero, which is M-S-H-E-K-E-R-O-W, at mylocalcaregiver.com.
Great.
That's our website.
Great. So my parting question that I always ask each guest is think back to your 20-year-old self. This morning, think back to that 20-year-old self of you. And if you were going to give them one piece of advice that you've learned, you know, on your journey, what would you tell your 20-year-old self today?
Aim high, which is what I have two little boys, so I constantly tell them to dream big. And so that's what I would tell myself and what I'll continue to tell my boys. Aim high. There's really no downside of doing that I've ever found. So aim high.
And I would have told myself that take something away from every experience. Don't always get upset and mad and go away in a huff. Stop and look and see what's really going on and take some kind of a benefit away with it instead of just being angry and such. Having a little more control is a good thing.
Oh, great.
And think before you talk.
Now, that's always a good one.
Can we pose a question to you, Michelle?
Absolutely.
What would you tell your 20-year-old self?
What would I tell? So, you know, you're the first person that has turned it around. That's impressive there,
Does that mean I
David.
Won't be back? Or?
No, that's great. There's so many things I could tell my 20-year-old self. I would say I had a favorite quote, and it was, "In the midst of winter, there is in you an invincible summer." And back then, I used to say those words, but what I would say is they really are true, that you, at the toughest times in your life, have something in you that can be that resilience to move past that thing you think you could not have moved past. And so that's what I tell myself. The other thing I would say is the thing that you think is such a winter in your life, you know, mm-hmm. it probably isn't. And you know, don't take it so seriously. It'll all work itself out.
That's great.
That was perfect, David. That was perfect. Well, thank you so much for being our guest. As I said, we'd love to have you back. And so join us next week, 10 o'clock on Fridays for Growth Matters, where we talk about all things growth, and have a great weekend.